Okay, good evening, folks. Welcome back. We have an incredible evening together. We are going to be focusing on Malachim. Malachim Aleph, Perek Zion to this evening. And we have ahead of us, the topic tonight is the palace and the architect. Okay, so these are two foci we're going to be focusing on tonight. We have looked at the actual construction of the Mikdash. We saw some of the uniquenesses in terms of the Ulam, the Heichal, and the Dvir, the entranceway, the port, and then the actual hall itself, and then the inner sanctum. We looked at that last time at the end of Perek Vav. What we're going to be focusing on this evening is the idea of Shlomo's own palace and the architect he chooses for the Beis HaMikdash. We're going to have a little bit of a chronological reverse here in some ways. So that's our focus for tonight. Moving to next week, God willing, we're going to look at the last section, the construction of the Beis HaMikdash, which deals with a lot of the water works, the Yam Shel Shlomo, the Mechonos, the basins, and a lot of the very unique aspects of the Beis HaMikdash. And this actually is a perfect opportunity to wish a Mazel Tov to Ellen on the engagement of Dina, which is very, very exciting. I know it's already a week old. And to Dina for the birth of a granddaughter yesterday afternoon. So, Mazal Tov, lots of wonderful, wonderful Mazal Tovs. Keep them coming, Bezrat Hashem. So, with that lovely news, let's start learning together. Our focus tonight is going to be essentially three paragraphs, and we're going to be looking at the first paragraph in the seventh perek, which runs from Pasuk Aleph to Pasuk Yud Beis. It's going to be very helpful to keep the translation close by. It's not so easy to understand the architecture. We're going to stick with a broader overview rather than a micro view. So here's how it goes. Ves Beisoi bono Shlomo shloish esrei shana. Shlomo made his house. This is in the packets with the actual writing. It's with the text itself. It's got the colored copy on the front. So it's Perek Zion, it's the seventh chapter on page 6. So he built his house for 13 years. Vayachal es kol beisoi, finishes his house. Vayiven es beis yar ha-Levanon, he made his house the forest of Lebanon. Me'ar amor arkoi v'chamishim amor arachbo yushloshim amor komosoi. So it was 100 cubits across, 50 in width and in length rather, and 30 high. Al arba'ot turei amudim arazim ukrusos arazim al ha'amudim. And it had these pillars. It had four rows of cedar pillars in the inside, and the rafters were cedar resting upon those pillars. V'safun bo'erez mimal al tzala'ois asher al ha'amudim arba'im v'chamisha chamisha asar hatur. And it's complicated to understand this, but it sounds like it was covered, the cedars are covered with side chambers that lay on 45 pillars, 15 in a row, which means to say it sounds like this was not a one-story building. There was multiple stories all supported by these pillars on the sides. Ushakufim shloshot turim, umecheze al mecheze shalosh pa'amim. And there were beams, three in rows, and the light over against light in three ranks, which I think that means to say is that the windows were facing one another. The eis ulam ha'amudim asa chamisha, chamishim amo arkoi u'shloshim amo arkoi. And then he had an ulam. An ulam is a porch or an antechamber. Oh, sorry, we are in the text. To ask him a pasuk? You're right. Thank you so much. Thank you, Barbara. V'chol ha'pesachim ha'amezuzois revu'im shakef u'mul mecheze al mecheze shalosh pamim. And the doors were square in frame. And they were all also sounds like facing one another. The eis ulam amudim asa chamishim amo arkoi. Then they had this porch, this entrance chamber, which was 50 amos in length, ushloshim amo arachboi, and 30 width. Ulam apaneihem amudim v'av alpaneihem. And it had pillars and thick beams before them. So it sounds like this was actually in front of the building. Ulam akisei asher yishpot sham ulam hamishpot. So then he made a chamber of judgment. The sofun be'erez, and it was covered or paneled with cedar, me'akarko v'ad ha'karko, from the floor to the floor, from all ends. U'beisa she'yeshev sham chatzer ha'acheres mi'beis lo'ulam, and the house that he would actually live in, that was on the other side of this court or this porch, k'ma'aseh hazeh haya, it was in a similar structure, u'vayis ya'aseh levas paroi, asher lokach shlomo ku'ulam hazeh, and he made another chamber for the daughter of Pharaoh, remember, who seems to be his first wife. Kol ele avonim yakorois, all of the stones that were made were hewn. They were very costly, or they were very precious. Kemidois gozis, they were cut stone. Megorarois b'magera, they were sawed with saws. Mibayis mechutz, inside and outside. Umimasod al tahatavachois. And the way they translate it is that even from the foundation onto the coping, umichutz al achotzer agadola, and on the outside to the great court, which means to say this wasn't just a haphazard collection of stones. These were specifically primed bricks that all fit into place. And the foundation stones were very big and very costly stones. They were 8 by 10 cubits. They were upon which everything else rested. And they had these hewn stones above them, which were made of stones and supported by cedar wood. Saviv, and they had a large courtyard around Shlosha Turim Gozis, which had three rows of beams, Vetur Kerusos Arozim, and it was a row of cedar beams around that, V'lachatzar Beis Hashem Pinyapinimis L'ulam Abayis, and like the inner court of Hashem and the court of the porch of the house, which means to say that like you had the Beis Hamikdash in the center of a larger courtyard, so too the palace was also surrounded by a courtyard, sort of a decorative area where people could gather. So again, it's the actual architecture is somewhat complicated. The general picture that we're getting over here is a multi-tier house, which is paneled with cedar. We don't have so much of the decorative details necessarily to this, but we do see a few interesting things. First of all, we see it as compared to the Beis HaMikdash, which sort of also pique our interest because it is the building of his house is proximate, is adjacent to the building of the Beis HaMikdash. We just finished building the Beis HaMikdash, and now we hear about the building of his palace. And we're going to have to contrast those two endeavors. You know, it's important. Unfortunately, today, it's become all too complicated when leaders get their personal life, so to speak, involved with communal life. But we're going to see that this doesn't sound like it's so much of a personal endeavor as much as it is also a communal endeavor as expressed in his palace, more than it being his potentially sleeping quarters, necessarily. So let's try to unpack this in a few ways. One interesting word which is used to describe this whole episode is or this whole building is it is called Ya'ar HaLevanon, Pasuk Beis. Ya'ar literally means a forest. Levanon means of Lebanon. So of Lebanon, of course, is very much a topic of ours up till now, because Lebanon is where in the north the beams or the trees are actually coming from, where the beams or the trees are coming from for the cedars, for the Beis HaMikdash. So that makes sense. Why is this called the Ya'ar Levanon, the forest of Lebanon? The Mitzuras David says a very beautiful thing. He says there's two alternatives as why this could be the case. Suggestion number one he makes is because, there's actually in the sources, but I'm just going to read it just to describe it out loud. One is that because if we were looking in the actual psukim, it sounds like there are a heck of a lot of trees that were used, but also when you look through this building, there are lots of pillars, right? Every level was supported by pillars, and there was three rows of pillars as you enter, which meant that the impression you would get by walking into this palace is you're entering into a wood of cedars. You're like walking into the forest of Lebanon itself. That was the image that would be conjured up while you walked in. Another dimension of this, he says, no, maybe it's just even simpler. Maybe it was made in a forest. You can't really see this from Jerusalem today, because Jerusalem today is a metropolis. But you reverse a number of years, this could have been, where was his palace situated? It was situated in the heart of a forest. Why would a king put his palace in a forest, argues the Mitzuras David?
It can be cool in the summer.
There you go. Very simple. They didn't have air conditioning. So says the Mitzuras David, maybe this was his summer house. This was the house in the hot summers. And in order for it to have the requisite, you had to hold court. You're dealing with judgments of very precarious natures, capital punishments sometimes. And you don't want the judges to be getting hot under the collar and wanting to close the case too fast. Right? You don't. That, and this is, we see that this is one of the reasons why this palace was used. He would hold court. One of the prime rooms would be to judge. So therefore, we're going to make sure that this was ultimately a very airy, and you could see the windows, the doors, the setup, the wind would be such a way. So maybe it isn't a description of the image of it, but it's a description of its whereabouts. as understood by this. It's just fascinating. One of the names of Shlomo's palace is the Forest of Lebanon, whether because of one of these two reasons, as is just fascinating. Let's just a few more basic questions here on this. Now, the second basic question over here is, it's called Ya'ar Levonon. How long did it take to make, the Psukim tell us?
13 years.
It took us 13 years. This is really interesting because, if you remember, at the very end of Perek Vav, it told us how long it took to make the Beis HaMikdash. How long did it take that to make? It took 7 years, actually 7.5. But exactly, but it was rounded off to be 7 years, which means, just you see something interesting over here. What's the story being told over here? Are those overlapping years? Are they separate years? That's a question which the Mefarshim deal with. And most of the Mefarshim settle with the fact that he only began the building of this building afterwards, because we're going to see a psukim later, a pasuk later on, which describes at 20 years is when he completed the two batim, the two houses, the Beis HaMikdash and the Ya'ar Levanan, which means putting together in a generalized fashion, we talk about 20 years, therefore making it that the two are one after the other. This is an important conclusion to reach, because that means to say that Shlomo HaMelech was separating personal, so to speak, or something somewhat personal from the Beis HaMikdash, right? He was able to split up those two so that there was no overlap. Because you can imagine that if you were doing the two concurrently and there had to be decisions which were made in terms of diverting energy and money and time, it would be a little bit of a conflict of interest to have one's own palace going up at the same time as the Beis HaMikdash, which is why it's very crucial to know that the one was following the other. So the 13 years versus the 7. So does this mean to say that it was a more complex structure to make and therefore it took longer? Is that what the time is telling us? So the Mefarshim actually say no. The Mefarshim say not at all. If you take a look at Rashi on the bottom of page 18, Rashi tells us a very simple point, a very succinct comment. He says, Ve'es Beisoy Bono Shlomo Shloish Yisrei Shana, took 13 years. Shebe Meleches Gavoya Nizdareis. He was more excessively involved when it came to building the Beis HaMikdash than when it came to his own contract. Right? It says, "Uvishivchoi sipera kosov," and this tells you, this is in fact to his credit, says Rashi. Fascinating. Over here. So what you see is you see a very, very powerful thing, and this is, you know, the Gemara tells us that if you want to see a person's real character, there's three chafs. Kisoi, Kasoi of a koisoi, which means, kiso means your pocket, your money, your money. You want to know what a person really is? Wait to see how they spend their money, or infringe their money and see what they really like. Or kasoi, when they get angry, is often related to the latter, right? And the third one is koisoi, when they drink too much, right? So that's so understand that when it comes to things that are important to people, that it matters financially to them, or there's passion involved, they do it very fast. They put all their eggs in the basket. I'm sure we know this. When there's something we're doing, and there's one predominant thing which is really driving us, everything else takes a back seat. And we'll make very obscure decisions, which to the onlooker will be absurd. Why would we be doing this? But to us, this is important. That's why sometimes when you deal with people and they make irrational decisions, you need to understand what's the story behind it. So we see over here as a fascinating thing. What is of matter to Shlomo? What really is getting him going is the building of the Beis HaMikdash more than his own home. That's a very unusual thing. That just to see a person putting so much time. We know how much for those who spend time doing home development. It takes a long time, and it is all consuming, all day and all night, right? But ultimately, he spent more effort when it came to the Beis HaMikdash than it did was in his own home, and this was to his shevach, right? By the way, anybody has spent time building a home, ever take 13 years, right? So Shlomo HaMelech, this is not because of the ebbing and flowing of funds. This is not the issue at stake. This was obviously took time, and he wasn't rushing. He had other quarters. He wasn't rushing to this. This is a shivcha shel Shlomo HaMelech. Let's take it one step further. In terms of, as we've looked at, Just to see what we looked at so far. We've looked at the name, and we've also looked at the timing, contrasting that timing to the Beis HaMikdash. There's one other thing which we should do is in terms of actual structure, footprint, right? So
space.
So how much space did it take up? We're told that the actual dimensions of the building, excluding the courtyard, is 100 by 50. And then we know it's 30 high. Right, 100 by 50. Just out of interest, does anybody remember the footprint of the actual Beis HaMikdash? Not the courtyard, the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Means to say, those three rooms, the Devir, the Heichal, and the Ulam. Does anybody remember what their dimensions were? 60 by 20. And so which means, it was the same height, 30. Which means that the Beis HaMikdash was smaller than Shlomo's palace. So wait a second. The whole theory that we were just thinking about in a moment ago, which the Mefarshim indicates that Rashi just said, is that, wait, he's spending much more time on his own house, on his own house, because he's slower at it. It's not as important to him as the Beis HaMikdash. But wait a second. But he made this Goliath structure. Right? So,
by ratio of 4.25 to 1.
That's huge. Right? This palace is incredibly huge. So, says the Abar Banel. Says the Abar Banel, who notices this specific point. Let's take a look at our source number 50. This is our Abar Banel on the top of page 19. He says, "Va'al yikshe alecha." Don't ask the question, "Eichos Shlomo es beisoy gadol mi beis Hashem." How could he make his house bigger than the Beis HaMikdash? It's a travesty. "Shehayosh shishim ama arkoi ve'eshim arach." But it was 60 by 20. This was in his house was 100 by 50. Why don't he make at least the same ratio? He says, at least keep the ratio, right? Meaning, make it right? It's 60 to 20. Make it a 1-to-3 ratio. He's making it a 1-to-2 ratio. At least make it on the same model, the scale. He doesn't do that. The basic assumption is let's try to make it something which reflects what you're doing, rather than going off on your own path and making something which is your own. You're right. You could challenge the second assumption. The first assumption is very strong. The first assumption is that how could it be that your palace is bigger than the Beis HaMikdash? And for that, that's a good question. Why? It was used by fewer people. The Kohen would only come in on number. Beis HaMelech hayinichnasim kol ha'am v'yitzarech liyosai orech v'orech gadol v'otzom. His court was huge. He would have ambassadors, he would have diplomats, he would have court cases, he would have people from all over the world and the known world coming to visit him and sample and to see. So for that, you needed to be able to hold such a court. This was not simply his little, you know, the White House where he lived. This was also the war room, this was also the judgment room, this was also the Supreme Court. Everything was happening in this house, therefore needed to be greater. Just to take this one step deeper, I just had a fascinating perspective when they were thinking of remaking Lahavdil, when they were thinking of remaking what was initially called the World Trade Center, Freedom Tower, now it's Tower One. So when they were initially making that, there's a lot of interesting history. If anybody wants to go and take a tour, it's fascinating. There's actually 8 sides to it. If you notice, there's 4 triangles at the top, 4 triangles at the bottom, which are merged into each other, which are the 8 sides of the old 2 trade centers. There's a lot of interesting, really, really fascinating thought that went into it. Do you know how tall it is? How many feet tall is it? Because you see, America had an opportunity because Erie's been playing this game, which is kind of like a very male kind of game. It's like, how can we make the tallest tower in the world? And so here was the opportunity where America could, like, you know, top the Arabs. What's the place called Khalifa, where in the middle of the desert, where there's a completely, you know, empty country of devoid of economy, and then a very, very big tall tower just to show we did it. That kind of, you know, so America had the opportunity of making the tower the tallest tower in the world, again, because it kind of oscillated, you know, between the Sears and the World Trade Center and the Empire State Building, if you follow the whole Guinness Book of World Records through the years. So how big is World Trade Center 1 or the Freedom Tower? Did anyone know? It's 1776. Meaning the brilliance of that decision was they weren't competing anymore. What were they saying? This is a building which represents a value. It doesn't represent being beating somebody else because it will be beaten. You know, I'll put a little spire on this Khalifa building out there in the Middle East, you know, because they want to just make it a little better. Or somebody else will finance another tower out in Asia. So the point was is that when you have a value system, then ultimately that's more important. And I think what Abarbanel is saying, Lahavdil, is that the dimensions of the Mikdash were sacrosanct. They were there for a precise point. It didn't need to be the biggest building. The question wasn't on Shlomo's palace. The question really was on the base of Mikdash. Meaning, Shlomo Melech needed this for practical purposes. The question is not about his big Mikdash, his palace. It's really about the base of Mikdash. Why was the base of Mikdash in these dimensions? And the answer is, it had very precise. There were specific spiritual guidelines as to what the base of Mikdash should look like. And ultimately, it was not the same needs. These weren't physical, diplomatic needs. These were spiritual needs. And it was based on principles rather than practical purpose. And therefore, we have, the Lahavdil, the 1776, which is in the base of Mikdash, in understanding the two in contrast. Let's dig. Yes.
Is there a correlation between the Mishkan and the Mikdash?
Yes, very much so.
Okay, so if this is the case, then God gave them the dimension.
100%, yes.
So
100%. So what we'll do is when we have time afterwards, because we haven't finished all the pieces of the Beis HaMikdash, we have one shiur next week on the end of it. What we'll do is then I'd like to try to just take a step backwards and do some of the contrasts and comparisons of the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash. But yes, it's coming from the same idea, which is God decided this is the way it should be. I'm just emphasizing exactly the point. This is the value-driven measurements as opposed to the bigness or the need. There we are.
They
did the economy slept in the Beis HaMikdash. Correct. Correct. So other aspects to it, but that was also God-given as well. So there was a practical element to it, but it was still God-given.
Only one family, then the rest didn't. It was a...
It depended on which Beis HaMikdash. We'll see, if you go through Maseches Tavit in the Mishnah, you'll see that the second or third Beis HaMikdash was very large and had many chambers. In Shlomo Melech, there's less detail about those things. We know a lot more about the second Beis HaMikdash, ultimately, just because it was much larger. Let's go through just one interesting perspective here. The Barbanel actually quotes Josephus in Antiquities as to describing the Beis HaMikdash, and he adds in some extra details which aren't to be found in the Pesukim, so I thought it would be fascinating to take a look at some of Josephus' descriptions to add a little bit of texture to this. This is on the bottom of page, or top of page 19. This is in Antiquities of the Jews, book 8, chapter 5, where he... by the way, what's he called in Hebrew when the Mephoshim quotes Josephus? Anybody know the name? It's called Yosifun ben Gurion. That's his name when Rashi quotes him or the Abarbanel quotes him. So Yosifun ben Gurion. So I thought, oh, if the Abarbanel's quoting him, why don't we actually look at where he said it himself? So here's what Josephus says about the Beis HaMikdash, about Solomon's temple. At the end of the first paragraph here, he says... towards actually in the middle of the paragraph, there's a sentence which starts with the word but. There's a period in the middle of the line. He says, but the palace, which was a building much inferior in dignity to the temple, both on the account of its materials, had not been so long beforehand gotten ready, nor had it been so zealously prepared. So number one is he points out another aspect which we'd also not focused on so much, and that is that the palace was less ornate. The materials were less ornate. Remember that we saw in the Beis HaMikdash that everything was gold leaf, right? So there was gold everywhere. So an element he points out is it just simply wasn't as precious as the Beis HaMikdash. That's one element of it, as in terms of space, but quality, the Beis HaMikdash was more impressive. Moving to the second paragraph, he describes a few fascinating things over here. If you take a look in the second paragraph, it's about seven lines in. If you look for the 23 in parentheses, then the line below that, it says, there was also another house so ordered that its entire breadth, notice the spelling, by the way, was placed in the middle. It was quadrangular, and its breadth was 30 cubits, having a temple over against it, raised upon massy pillars, in which temple there was a large and very glorious room wherein the king sat in judgment. To this, there was joined another house which was built for the queen. So those are descriptions we have seen in the Pesukim. There were other smaller edifices for diet and sleep after public matters were over. And these were all floored with boards of cedar. Some of these Solomon built with stones of 10 cubits and wainscoted the walls with other stones that were sawed. and were of great value, such as dug out of the earth for the ornaments of temples, and to make fine prospects in royal palaces, and which make the mines where they are dug famous. Now, this is the part, actually, this is the more interesting. The contexture of the curious workmanship of these stones was in three rows, but the fourth row would make it make one admired sculptures, whereby were represented trees and all sorts of plants, with the shades that arose from their branches and the leaves that hung down from them. Those trees and plants covered the stone that was beneath them, and their leaves were wrought so from them. They were from prestigious and thin and subtle that you would think they were in motion. Isn't that beautiful? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it almost looked as if the trees hewed into that last pillar looked like they were actually in motion. But the other part of the roof was plastered over and, as it were, embroidered with colors and pictures. He moreover built other edifices for pleasure, as also very long cloisters, and those situate in an agreeable place of the palace, and among them a most glorious dining room for feasting and compotations, and full of gold and other furniture, as so fine a room ought to have for the conveniency of the guests, and where all the vessels were made of gold. Now it is very hard to reckon up the magnitude and the variety of the royal apartments, how many rooms there were of the longest sort, how many of the biggest in bigness inferior to those, and how many that were subterraneous and invisible. Coming back to your point, Ira, meaning even beneath the ground. And the curiosity of those that enjoyed the fresh air and the groves for the most delightful prospect for the avoiding the heat and covering of their bodies. So you just see some of the extra details that he's adding in over here, which just are fascinating. Hard to know where he's drawing some of this from. But there seems to be, we have a vagueness as to how many rooms, how deep were the rooms, was it in the mountainside like you were suggesting, Dina? There's some interesting things, but the decorative and the, we'll call it entertaining section of the palace was also very rich in furniture, is what we're hearing as well. So we're hearing a very beautiful picture.
It took him 13 years, not the fact that he
interesting.
Didn't, you know, I mean, there's a lot of...
There are a lot of detail here. There is a lot of detail. You're right. So it could be that. At the same time, the Beis HaMikdash had a sufficient amount of detail too with all that gold work. So again, Rashi still seems to say that for the ratio of time was not proportional. That's necessary. One last piece over here. Yes.
Materials that David HaMelech had gotten that wasn't used for bathing?
That's a great question. I don't remember offhand. I don't remember because he didn't utilize those. He used his own collections. So I don't know. That's a very good question, and I don't remember. That's an excellent question. I don't remember how that worked.
See, the base of the biggest was already set up, so he only had to follow the plan. He didn't have to start something new. But his own, he had to do it from scratch.
Correct.
But he didn't.
But he didn't use everything that David HaMelech gave him.
He didn't use everything, but it was already...
No, he didn't use any of it. He didn't use any of it. So it might have been that maybe it was used for this. I'm not sure. I can't comment on it. I don't remember. But you're saying it was more simple. Yes, there's no question that the base was more simple because he had the plan and the blueprint. Here it was almost setting up the stateroom by yourself from scratch. There is one interesting addition here, which I thought was fascinating also to notice, is the part of the palace, the wing of the palace, the ulam, which was set up for Bas Paro, right? It almost indicates that she has a special place in Shlomo Melech's heart. She was listed as the first person he marries. He sets up her own palace. It is interesting, though, to note that the Mefarshim debate whether he intended to do this or he actually did this. Where does this come up? Is the beginning of Az Yashir, when the Bnei Yisrael are about to sing in Parshas Beshalach, which is going to be in a couple weeks' time. We see that this is a famous Rashi, the Ramban quotes, but most we hear this Rashi, we don't actually focus on the Pesukim in Nach, because that's Nach, but we're learning Nach, so now we can appreciate it. Listen to what the Ramban says in this source, which actually gives us an interesting perspective in source 52. I'm going to try to make the writing a little bigger in future, okay, in the sources. In source 52, it says, Az Yashir Moshe, Lashon Rabbeinu Shlomo, he quotes Rabbeinu Shlomo as Rashi, Kesheru Anes, Ola Bilibo, Yashir Shira. They're trying to work out what the word Az means. Then he sang. Then. When's then? So it says, Az, he thought about singing. V'chein Asa V'yomru Lemor, V'chein Az Yadaber Yoshua, Similarly, in Tanakh, we have the idea of then Yoshua thought to say, "Kesheroa nais amar loy liboy." He said to his heart, "The daber." V'chein also vayomer eleni Yisrael. V'chein shira sabeir shepasach baaz yoshir Yisrael. Pirsha acharav ali beir nula. They thought to sing the song afterwards. V'chein ubayis yaase lebas paro har perek. And he made a palace, or he made a space for the daughter of Pharaoh. Choshav b'libo la'asoy slo bayis. He intended to make to her house. Did he make a house for her? Not clear. The point is, he had all good intentions. Did that end up happening? Not so clear. There's a little bit of ambivalence as to that element of the planning. Just putting that out there as to this, it does give us more of a gravitas in terms of his connection to her. This is paragraph number one. Paragraph number two for tonight is going to be the architect. We've thought about the palace briefly of Shlomo. Let's think about the architect of this palace. Here's a palace. He's a very interesting name. Here's how it goes. It says, as this is on, we're going back into our actual texts of Tanakh for this part, and we're only reading two psukim. These are psukim Perek Zayin, Pasuk Yud Gimel, and Yud Dalet. We meet our architect. Vayishlach haMelech Shlomo, vayikach es Chiram Mitzor. He sends and he takes Chiram from Tyre. Benisha Almona, who umimatay leNaphtali. He is from the. He is the son of a widow from the tribe of Naphtali. Vaviv ish tzorir choresh nechashis. His father was, it sounds like, a man of Tyre. A Tyrian? Not sure if that's the way we say it. Who was a coppersmith. Vaymolei esa chochma v'esa tvuna v'esa das la'asoyz komelech melacha b'nechashis v'yavoa la'melech shlomo v'yas es kol melachtoi. And he came to Shlomo to prepare all his work. So first of all, interesting point is, it seems that in Tyre, Hiram is a popular name, because that's the name of the king too. Okay, so that's just he did not summon the king. Okay, that was not what was happening. This is another fellow whose name was the same name as the king. Okay, so this is something which can happen. Whether he was named because of the king or whether because this was a popular name in Phoenician culture, we don't know. But this is not the king himself. So he summons this individual. It sounds like a little bit at this point, if we just read the Pshat HaPsukim, it sounds like he is from a mixed marriage of sorts. It sounds like that because it says his father was a man of Tyre who was a coppersmith, and his mother was from the tribe of Naphtali. So it sounds like maybe an intermarriage over here. It is interesting to note that there is a parallel account of the same man in Divrei HaYamim, because remember, Divrei HaYamim is parallel. The chronicles are directly parallel to Sefer Menachem, and we really ought to be reading the two of them side by side to notice the differences. Here's where one difference arises. Take a look at source 56. You have the actual sources here. This is where in Divrei HaYamim describes the same episode. Va'atosh shalachti, Hiram the king says to Shlomo, Ish chacham yodea bina l'churam avi. He was a very intelligent man to my father Huram. So there's three Hirams now. Hiram was the king number, this is Hiram number two speaking, who's the king. His father was Hiram number one. And Hiram number one had a servant whose name was Hiram. Okay, so in case we're not sufficiently confused, that's why he doesn't mention his name right now. Benisha Benos Dan. He was from a daughter, from a woman from the tribe of Dan. But now, this man comes from a tribe of Dan and a Tyrian man. So, who was he? This sounds like a very complex kind of individual. Where is his background? Where does he come from exactly? The Mephoreshim spent a lot of time trying to work out what was unique about him or where he really came from. And the Eved Gomorrah itself has a very unique Pshat over here, which says as follows. Let's just see where this actual source is. Rashi quotes this in. Here we go. In 57. Thank you. Yes. V'ish aviv v'aviv ish tzori Yehudi ha'yo yoshev betzor. He was a Jewish man. He lived in Tyre. Dugma oved Edom hagiti. His father was really a Jewish man who lived in Tyre and is called a Tyrian man, like you see, Oved Edom is called Agiti because he lived in Gat. Not that he was a Philistine, but that was he was known by his place because he was the Jewish merchant who lived there. So he was called the Jew from Tyre. And he was really a Levi. Okay. So wait a second. But now if we contrast the two, Rashi says, is he from Naphtali or is he from Dan? Which tribe is he from? Ella imai midan va'aviv mi Naftali. If we assume that he really is a Jewish individual, he's an Israelite, who's called an Ishtzori because that's where he lives, therefore now we have two sides of the family. So on the one hand, he was from Dan, and the other side of the family is from Naftali. So now, Rashi asks the critical question. So why all the lineage? Why do we need to know all of this? Why is it so important to know? And then the contrast and the Naftali and Dan, and why is this necessary? When Rachel was having children through her maidservant, Bilhah, she called these children Dan and Naftali. And they were ultimately precursors to Yosef and Binyamin. She didn't have children yet. And she was saying, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're allowing me a foot in the door, so to speak, into the Shvatim, through these children, vicariously. So she says, Amra Rachel, me'ata ikamti petulim akmimuyus asisi, ad shani yachola ledamois atzmi lelea. I've been doing all the subterfuge to become part of the family. It's so difficult just to have a child with Yaakov. Lelea achoti imlea, titpa'er bebetzalel, bebenashi yaaseh. Hamishkan, Lelea is going to have a child who's going to be the architect of the very house of God called Betzalel. Therefore, yitztarech lishtatep imelachtoi echad mi b'nei don sherat, So why is the Tanakh spending all this time to tell us this? It's because it wasn't Bezalel who took the full cake in the architectural structure of the base of the Mishkan. It was also Eliyav ben Achisamach lemate Dan. What do we see over here? The Tanakh is emphasizing that Rachel had also dibs in the construction of the Beis HaMikdash through Naftali and Dan, which were ultimately her first foray into the Shiftei Yisrael through her maidservant Bilhah in the historical picture. Fascinating. This is her way in, which, by the way, now gives us a very interesting perspective. What the Gemara is essentially telling us, or that Rashi is telling us over here, is that the Mikdash, in a certain sense, is an expansion upon the original blueprint of the Mishkan. This is what's happening, which is coming back to the point that was raised just a moment before, is we're seeing the same patterns unfolding of the Dan and Naftali element of the construction of the Beis HaMikdash being necessary for Tanakh to emphasize as it unfolds when it comes to this. It's interesting that the part of Tanakh which emphasizes the precise parallel to the Mishkan is more Divrei Hayamim, Chronicles, which emphasizes the Dan aspect more than Melachim. Food for thought as to why that should be. I'm just putting it out there. But nonetheless, one level more than this, you see. And that is what the Gemara itself says, and just an interesting connection. The Gemara tells us in Erechin, very practical piece of advice. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, minayin shelo yeshane adam me'emunoso me'emunos avosov, shenemar, vayishlach ha-melech shlomo vayikach eschira mitzor, benishal mona, hu umimate naftali v'aviv ish tzari chareshes nechoshes. How do you know that you should always adopt the family business? Sometimes it's successful, sometimes not as successful. You should always adopt the family business because this man, what was his job as he joined the Beis HaMikdash team? He became a coppersmith. And therefore, what was he doing? He was following his father's initiation. His father was a coppersmith. But then the Gemara goes on one further step. V'amar mar, imemi beis don, dichsiv, itoi beis aliyah ben achisamach lamatei don. It wasn't just his father. It was Eliyahu ben Achisamach, his great-great-great-great-grandfather, who was also a coppersmith, who was also an artisan. And therefore, that's why this was the tradition in the family, which ultimately came out well, because he was recruited to be part of the Beis HaMikdash team using the same traits of his father. What the Gemara is essentially doing is the same thing, which is we're seeing the expansion of the same theme, which is the Mishkan was made, now the Beis HaMikdash is made, and we see similar strands of architectural skill which is emerging. One basic question over here, and that is don't you think this is a little late for the architect to walk in? Meaning, think about this for a second. We spent the whole Perek Vov describing the creation of the Beis HaMikdash. So if that's the case, he should have been introduced to us at the beginning of Perek Vov. Why? Who are you? Good morning. Where did you come from? So it's interesting that if you read Divrei HaYamim, you will notice actually the psukim that we quoted, that we learned together just a moment ago, actually do come at the very beginning of the story. So he was introduced at the beginning of the story, which would introduce them and maybe suggest that maybe over here, as Dina was suggesting, that en muqdama muakhar, that there's another order which governs rather than chronology. But I would like to argue the following. Is, up till now, have we dealt with any copper smithing? No. Are we about to? Yes. Which means that the maybe the specific skill which he is being, now of course there's das, chokhma, tvuna, and all the other things, but the specific element which the Melachim Aleph is underscoring at this point in time is his workmanship in copper, which is about to be expressed in some very, very complex edifices, which are going to be the two pillars entering the Beis Hamikdash, which we will have many psukim on, and the Yamshel Shlomo, the basin of Shlomo, which is going to be this incredible, this miraculous edifice, which is going to be there for hand washing, and these mechonos. So these, we're going to see perhaps why his involvement is here. We don't have a chance to get to Yachin and Boaz today, unfortunately. We will get to them next week. But I do want to end off with one last quote, and that is the quote of Rashi himself, who tells us what was so special about this individual. What chokhmah did he really have? And to this, to that end, if you take a look in source 55, which we didn't get a chance to get to look inside, he tells us now, "Vaymalei esa chokhmah v'esatvuna v'esadas." He had three things: chokhmah, bina, and das. Right? That's Chabad. Those three ideas. Shlosha klei umunos shalom nivra bohem. These were three implements through which the world itself was created. Shene'emar v'chokhmah yisad oretz. What were the tools with which he was recruited to build the Beis HaMikdash? Not just that he could make a pretty statue, not that he could just carve out a lovely pattern on a wall, but the point was that he actually understood the metaphysical underpinnings of reality, which means what he was doing, like one of the ideas of what the Mishkan was not an extension of Sinai, but a parallel creation of the world. If you think about that, that makes a whole lot of sense, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu fashioned the world and created a space called Tzimtzum in which humanity can exist. And what did humanity do at the apex of their spiritual success was they carved out a little space of themselves for God to dwell in. And if you think about that, that's why the two ideas have to be parallel. What he is doing essentially the creation process, carving out of himself, out of the human domain, for the divine domain, which requires the same wisdom that the divine needed, so to speak, or had, when carving up the space for the human domain, which is the parallel which is necessary here. So this is not simply architecture 101. This is metaphysics, which is unfolding, and perhaps we'll take a look at some of those examples specifically next week when we get to the pillars and some of the metaphysical underpinnings of this. Thank you, folks. Thank you for taking the time.